Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabat Ahwai. The Yemeni army says it has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is, by some accounts, the tourism and commercial hub of the Persian Gulf region, at least for now. The Yemeni army has warned foreign firms and investors to leave the UAE, as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. Will the UAE change track, or will it gamble its entire country to continue a losing war along with its big brother, Saudi Arabia? Just one of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight.
A war Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched on Yemen has taken a new twist, with the Yemeni army now opening a new front, the United Arab Emirates. Last week, the Yemeni army fired a number of missiles and drones into the heart of the UAE, usually an oasis of calm in the often volatile region. The Yemenis have done it again, targeting the UAE as well as Saudi Arabia as part of their retaliatory attacks on aggressors.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area.
The Sheikhdom claims it intercepted two ballistic missiles with no casualties on Monday, but it made no comment on any drone or missile attacks. Saudi Arabia has also confirmed some missiles hit south of the kingdom, but says some projectiles were intercepted. The Yemeni army is now warning firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. A journalist says the Yemeni army aims to hit the UAE where it hurts, the economy.
The UAE is a hub of international commerce and international trade. And in fact, without international global finance, this country would not prosper, would barely even, exist as a modern state.
The strikes are part of reprisal attacks over nearly seven-year-long deadly Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis. Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strike by Saudi war machines that claimed dozens of more innocent lives, including children. The United Arab Emirates is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the war. It remained involved in the aggression despite announcing its withdrawal from the alliance 2 years ago. Now the question is, isn't it time for the Emiratis to think before playing into the hands of Saudis? A political commentator says the recent attacks are a clear message for Sheikhdom to avoid playing its destructive role.
The role of United Arab Emirates in Yemen has been so bad and so damaging so destructive against Yemeni civilians. And I think that United Arab Emirates, they should be really careful to target Yemen from now on.
Relentless bombing campaigns against Yemen and the blockade of the country have so far proved futile for Riyadh and its allies to achieve their intended goals. It remains to be seen if Emirati leaders will change their course of actions and stop partnering with Saudi Arabia in its long-running war on the Arab world's poorest country and continue to face the consequences of their aggression.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is an activist and political commentator, Leif Maruf, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Leif Maruf, I'm going to start with you. And let's take a look in your eyes, the strength that the Yemeni army is displaying. As Yahya Sari, the spokesman for the Yemeni army, said, ballistic missiles were fired at the Al Dhafra air base in Abu Dhabi, which is also used by the U.S. It also targeted other sensitive areas, based on the spokesperson of what he said. He said they had also launched drones towards Dubai. At the same time, the Yemeni army launched attacks against Saudi Arabia. So tell us about the strength and the sheer power that the Yemeni army has, so we can get an overview of that.
Well, let's remember that just a few days before this retaliatory attack, the Saudi and Emirati forces bombarded Sa'da province in the north of Yemen and Hudaydah and Sana'a with huge bombs, destroying a prison, killing hundreds of people, using bunker busters to supposedly reach the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army has. And what we have as a response, as expected, the Yemenis responded with hellfire and attacking military and economic sites in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi. So this shows us that the intelligence gathering capabilities of the Americans and their vessels in the Gulf is almost null. They were not able to hit any of the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army holds. And what we saw by these brazen attacks on multiple Saudi military bases in the south and the air base in the United Arab Emirates is that the air defenses that the Americans and the Israelis have sold to these vessels in the Gulf are useless. I mean, the videos that we watched of these missiles going up in the air in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and not hitting any target, and some of them even falling back down onto the ground on the civilians and inhabited areas of Dubai and Abu Dhabi, that shows you how number one, how great the work of the Yemeni army is and how irrelevant and useless the defensive strategies of both Saudi and Emirates are.
Sure. Now, taking a look, Daniel Kovalik, at the size of the UAE, what is it, about 83,000 square kilometers. The U.S. is by far a lot larger, and we can compare that to maybe a small state in the U.S. Given that perspective, we are looking now at a game changer. The Yemeni army spokesperson has said, we advise foreign companies and investors in the UAE to leave as it has become unsafe, and basically threatening the investment that's happening there, the tourism that happens in that country. Why is the UAE taking a gamble that could cost it the entire country?
Well, we'll see how long they do take that gamble. I think they're taking it for now because they do have pressure on them from the U.S., from Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, Israel, to continue this war against Yemen, which all the parties I just mentioned have some role in. And so the UAE being...
Okay, expand on that if you can. I'm sorry to jump in. When you say they have a role, are they dictating to the UAE what to do? Is that what you mean?
That is my sense, certainly. I don't think the UAE has the capacity to wage any type of war on its own, and probably would not, but that it is getting pressure from these other countries that have a huge say in the UAE because of the financial interests that they have in that country. And so the UAE essentially is acting like a client state here, and that is why they're putting everything, as you say, on the line here. But again, how long they can or will do that is unclear.
Well, Leif Maruf, then, I'm trying to figure out the thinking here. If I'm sitting in the palace there in the UAE or Dubai or Abu Dhabi, wherever they have it, do they understand that the UAE could become collateral damage of this war? Because again, it's so small, it's within range. The Yemeni army is warning it now, it seems, every few days, withdraw from this war. And it's hitting the UAE deep. And yet they're continuing with this. So is it, are the financial returns worth it in their minds to be pressured by the U.S., by Israel, in this case, and maybe Saudi Arabia also?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously these states are vassals, but more so when we talk about the UAE, because the UAE is not a country that existed before British colonialism. You know, the area used to be called the Desert of Oman or the Desert of Bahrain prior to the British colonization and the creation of this state. This country is 10 million inhabitants, but 9 million of them are non-citizens that are foreign workers, which means this is the economy of the country is exaggerated and is dependent on the foreign workers that are servicing international businesses. And this, you know, adds another layer, which shows that the United Arab Emirates is actually one of the few countries in the world that are directly controlled by corporations. When we talk about 9 out of 10 people are foreign workers, who are they working for? They're working for foreign international companies. And those international companies are the ones that make the decisions. And as we see, the Yemenis have done a very smart thing addressing these corporations that actually control the country and saying to them that this state will statelet, as actually the spokesperson of Yemen called it, this statelet will not be a safe business place. And if this continues, and they will lose their money. And many of these foreign workers, if actual, you know, the United Arab Emirates it turns into a war zone, they will pack up and leave. Therefore, this country not only is built out of glass towers, but the whole economy of it, the whole existence of it, is a glass tower situation that will collapse very easily. And unfortunate for the Emiratis, because they are not sovereign and they can't take these decisions. The decision will come from these corporations.
Yeah, indeed. Well, in the U.S., there are Democrats, Daniel Kovalik, that are against this war. As a matter of fact, when Joe Biden was running during his campaign trail, he said that he's going to end the war. But recently, Democrats came out and wanted clarification, as they called it, from the U.S. president. They said this is vague, what is happening. Congressman Peter DeFazio, one of them, that said that Washington needs to offer more than just vague declarations. I don't quite get what is vague about this when Biden just weeks ago approved the over $600 million in arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
There is nothing vague about it. I mean, to put a finer point on it, Biden lied when he said he was going to stop supporting the war. He knew that the war was unpopular amongst liberals who at least understood what was happening there. This is, as you mentioned at the outset, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and it is being created by this unprovoked war. And it has to be pointed out, this was not started by Saudi Arabia with the help of President Obama, it must be said, because it was attacked by Yemen. It was started because Riyadh did not like the government in Yemen. That is not a basis under international law to start a war, and it has created the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. And so again, liberals who are paying any attention have been opposed to this war. Biden knew that, so he simply said, I'm going to stop supporting it, and then he went on and continued supporting it. That's what's happened. There's nothing vague about it. He lied, and very few people have held him to account. And even now, there's very few Democrats who are putting pressure on him to stop this.
Let's talk about the unspoken of this war, Laith Maruf. One of the things that people don't realize, and that is a particular flashpoint that has become known as the port of Balhaf, from what I'm reading here. This is basically a seaport, and the UAE, when it began this war, has actually taken this seaport over, this area. so much so that it ousted the governor, and then the locals there are obviously very disturbed by the fact that the UAE has taken over their sovereignty of this particular area. This was once an economic lifeline for the Yemenis, but now it's basically a military camp for the UAE. These are the unspoken of the war. And it's a seaport, and it seems like the UAE is very interested in these port towns. Doesn't that show that there's a violation of the sovereignty taking place, not reported, obviously?
Yes, and it goes more than that. You know, I'm glad you mentioned this story, because the Yemeni army and resistance bombed the main UAE base in this port city and leveled to the ground the base, killing hundreds of militias that belong to the UAE and some sergeants and officers that are from the UAE military. And as you know, they were so, you know, angry that they chased away the governor, who is one of their men, you know, so they blamed him for their own failures. And the story here with this port and many of the other ports of Yemen and many of the islands of Yemen, including Socotra and the islands on the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, actually connects to the Zionist colony. And today, in the statements of the Yemeni officials, they said that they have some evidence to direct involvement of the Zionists in the attacks that just occurred a few days ago by the Saudis and Emiratis on Yemen, with that huge massacre of over 300 civilians killed, and said that they are investigating, and if they have full, you know, confidence in this evidence, they will be retaliating against the Zionist colony. And if you read the Israeli media today, they are really worried, because the ballistic missiles and drones of Yemen that reached all the way to Abu Dhabi and Dubai and could reach very easily Eilat and the Naqab Desert, and can retaliate on those attacks, mm-hmm. if proven by that the Zionists, you know, were involved. So this is now going to escalate further than the Americans could ever imagine.
Daniel Kobalik, it's shouldn't be really that surprising when when the attack took place by the Yemeni army the last time around on the UAE. The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett came out and said, "We stand ready to offer you security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks." Are we looking at Israeli direct involvement, as our guest there said, and then for them to also then become a target?
Well, I certainly would not be surprised if there is a direct level of involvement by Israel. Israel is very opposed to the Houthi government in Yemen. It sees it as a threat to its own regional influence, and so I have no doubt that it has a lot of involvement. We probably don't know how much in this war. And yes, if it's proven that it had some direct involvement in this war crime, and that's what it was, a war crime that killed at least 100 civilians, including children, then it is certain that Yemen will retaliate against Israel. And it has a right to do that. You know, there's this bizarre almost assumption that the U.S. and Israel are the only countries in the world that have a right to self-defense, and everyone just has to take a beating. And the Houthis are saying, no, that's not the case. We have the right to defend ourselves. And I think we're going to see more out of the Houthis that are going to demonstrate that.
So to conclude here, Leif Maruf, I'm looking at the drawing board, and I'm saying, okay, the UAE has become a victim. Saudi Arabia, obviously, is in danger. You have, well, Israel's involvement. Israel becomes a target. You have how the regional dynamics have now changed, which could engulf maybe the Persian Gulf region, because you're looking at potential risk to danger, for example, to energy pipelines, production facilities, stock market to have somewhat dipped in Abu Dhabi, and also other stock markets in the region. U.S. citizens warning UAE, their citizens in the UAE to leave or to be very cautious, I should say, I'll rephrase that. all of the downside of this whole thing outweighs the participation of the bombing campaign that's killing civilians. Why do they continue this war?
Because the Americans lost the war in Syria, lost the war in Iraq, lost the war in Gaza and in Palestine and in Lebanon, and now they only see as the Yemenis as a punching bag to continue proving that they are virile. And what's actually the Yemenis are doing is crushing their you know, they're crushing them hard openly, you know. And what the danger is for all of us in Western Asia here living is that we know that the Americans and their vessels act in coordination on all fronts. We also know that the resistance axis has, since the war on Palestine last year, have said they are also coordinating all their activities. So we don't know an attack on Yemen that is responded to you know, in Palestine, how it could, you know, roll out in the whole region. We don't also know even if there's a trigger in Iraq or Syria or in Lebanon that could trigger a regional, confrontation. And this is where the danger is, lies between the, you know, supremacy of the Zionists and the Americans, and the reality on the ground that they can't apply this supremacy anymore.
Uh-huh.
And because of this anger that they have, we could see ourselves in a regional war at any moment.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you for your contribution, Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Daniel Kabalik, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who spoke to us from Pittsburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَيَوْمَ
and mention the day he will gather them and that which they worship besides Allah, and will say, did you mislead these, my servants, or did they themselves stray from the way? They will say, exalted are you. It was not for us to take besides you any allies, but you provided comforts for them and their fathers until they forgot the message and became a people ruined.
The 17th verse of the chapter says, وَيَوْمَ يَحْشُرُهُمْ وَمَا يَعْبُدُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ فَيَقُولُ أَأَنْتُمْ أَضْلَلْتُمْ عِبَادِي هَؤُلَاءِ أَمْ هُمْ ضَلُّ السَّبِيلِ. And remember the day he will muster them, and that which they worship instead of Allah, and he shall say, was it you who misled these my servants, or did they themselves go astray from the way? This verse, dear listeners, is talking about the pagans and their deities that will be put to question in the resurrection. As you have been with us, the previous verses talked about the fate of the believers and the pagans in hereafter, and also the rewards of the believers and the punishments of the pagans. The 17th and also 18th verse continue this subject in another way. The question that Almighty Allah asks pagans' deities in the resurrection, and their answer to this question are mentioned here as warning. But in the 17th verse, only the question is mentioned. وَيَوْمَ يَحْشُرُهُمْ وَمَا يَعْبُدُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ. Remember the day he will muster them and that which they worship instead of Allah. فَيَقُولْ أَأَنْتُمْ أَضْلَلْتُمْ عِبَادِ هَؤُلَاءِ. And he shall say, was it you who misled these my servants? أَمْ هُمْ ضَلُّ السَّبِيلِ. Or did they themselves go astray from the path? Regarding the beginning part of the verse, in the Holy Quran, there are different occasions that the verses talk about misleading and being misled by some other people. For example, one of them is not having a good friend. لَقَدْ أَضَلَّنِي عَنِ الذِّكْرِ. The Holy Quran says that in the hereafter, some people will claim that our friends have misguided us. Some others will mention in the day of resurrection that their own selves, that their own souls and lusts have misguided them. وَلَا تَتَّبِعِ الْحَوَى فَيُذِلَّكَ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. You should not follow your own selves orders because they will misguide you from the path of Almighty Allah.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly
the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Also, the Holy Quran mentions that sometimes the learned and knowledgeable people will misguide and mislead you if they are deviant. About them, the Holy Quran says, يَكْتُبُونَ الْكِتَابِ بِأَيْدِيهِمْ ثُمَّ يَقُولُونَ هَذَا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ. They write some information from their own, and they say this has come from the Almighty Allah. This has been sent down by the Almighty Allah. And also, the most obvious one, Satan himself. إِنَّهُ عَدُوٌ مُضِلٌ مُبِينٌ, the Holy Quran says. Anyway, since the origination of these misguidings and misleadings are different, the Holy Quran asks this question. أَأَنْتُمْ أَضْلَلْتُمْ عِبَادِي هَؤُلَاءِ. You may remember in the previous programs we talked about why the Almighty Allah asks different questions in the verses of the Holy Quran. Sometimes the incentive behind questioning is for understanding. فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ, the Holy Quran says. But sometimes it is for mere reproach. أَأَنْتَ قُلْتَ لِلنَّاسِ اتخذوني وأمي إلهين من دون الله. The Almighty Allah to reproach the followers of Jesus عليه السلام asks him that were you the one who told the people to follow you and your mother as other deities and other gods? In this case, the addressee was the Prophet, it was Jesus, but it was for reproaching of the others. And sometimes the question is asked from the same person who has done something wrong. In this case, أَمْهُمْ ضَلُّ السَّبِيلِ, the Holy Quran says. Or they themselves went astray from the way. Brothers and sisters, there are some points to be mentioned regarding the 17th verse of the chapter that we will inshallah discuss in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation.
That was how Joe Biden laid out the path for his presidency during his inaugural address on the 6th of January, 2021. It came after supporters of his predecessor Donald Trump raided the Capitol Hill in a deadly unrest because the former president refused to accept defeat and claimed an election fraud. Speaking exactly a year after he took office, Biden said he had not overpromised in his inaugural speech on what he could achieve. Yet a review of the status quo in the United States tells a different story. Back in October, a poll showed that 41% of Biden's supporters and 52% of those who voted for Trump want Republican and Democratic-led states to secede and form two new countries. The divide continues to define the American society and politics to the day. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate blocked Biden's key legislation to protect voting rights for African Americans and other minorities, especially in the Republican-controlled states. Democrats pushed the legislation amid restrictive voting in some Republican-led states, which Democrats see as a slow-motion coup to retake the White House in the next presidential election. Republican-led states also moved to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. That's teaching students on the history of slavery and racism and how they shaped U.S. institutions and policy to ensure the dominance of white people. One such ban did actually become law in Mississippi on Saturday. The debates hark back to racial tensions triggered by the fatal shootings of African Americans, which have ignited some of the most serious social unrest of the modern times in the U.S. A case in point in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in November. The not guilty verdict in the trial was an affront to those who saw the teenager as a murderer, butting into a protest against racial injustice and killing two demonstrators. The ruling, however, was a gift to those who saw Rittenhouse as a right-wing patriot. Over the past year, the U.S. has also seen huge divisions among Republican and Democratic voters over such issues as the conservative-led push to restrict constitutional abortion rights, obligatory vaccination against the coronavirus, and even Democratic-led attempts to curb access to guns. These have also been key areas of political point scoring among Republicans and Democrats.
One thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for?
Deep divides have always been there among Democrats and Republicans and their supporters, but the Capitol Hill insurrection seems to have radicalized things. Trump continues to enjoy backing from Republicans after he triggered the insurrection by the claim that Biden won the election by vote rigging. This has polarized American politics more than ever before. The insurrection has also sent reverberations through the American society, dividing people across political and racial lines.
Things started out peacefully on Sunday as an estimated 50,000 protesters took to the streets of Brussels in opposition to COVID-19 vaccines and the requirement to show certificates in order, for example, to eat in a restaurant or travel. However, things turned ugly as police were attacked by some of the demonstrators. Tear gas and water cannon were then deployed to break up the crowds. Prior to the clashes, we spoke to some of those in attendance.
Do you think the vaccine is dangerous?
I'm sure that it is dangerous.
There's no problem with the vaccine. If you want a vaccine, okay. But if you don't want it, please leave us be.
The European United Group, which organized the event, claims it's not anti-vax, but it certainly didn't sound that way.
To Mr. Bill Gates, we say, you might mean well with your vaccines, but we don't need them.
The data is indisputable. Lockdowns followed by vaccines when they became available are measures that have saved millions of lives. But some insist the inoculation drive is going too far.
Children shouldn't be vaccinated. We have an immune system. We shouldn't do this. This is an experiment.
For others, the booster campaign is an issue.
I had my basic vaccines because I work in healthcare. But booster after booster, it's not okay.
The 27-nation EU has a population of just under 450 million. 20% of adults are refusing to take a COVID-19 vaccine. That is clearly a very significant minority. Epidemiologists say if they did take the jab, most of the restrictions these people are protesting against could be lifted much more quickly. Anarchists managed to reach the offices of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Police are promising arrests in the coming days. The protesters are promising they will be back out on the streets here again next Sunday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On behalf of the youth concerning justice for the world, a new paradigm response to the leader's letters to the youth in Western countries. The title of a 90-page book authored by retired British binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare.
The book addresses the main issues for the world today. For example, there's massive inequality. There are preposterous accumulations of wealth. There's no justice. The exportation of justice is in fact in the example that Iran is capable of giving as Iran develops the resistance economy.
The book, to be translated into multiple languages, picks up on two open letters penned by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the wake of a rise in terrorist attacks in 2015, among them the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which fueled Islamophobia in the West.
Islamophobia started immediately after Islamic Revolution in Iran, although it surprised many in the world, they didn't have any strategy or plan, following which several false flag operations were created to damage the image of Islam. And it was necessary then to address the issue.
In those letters circulated widely online, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Western youth not to believe prejudiced portrayals of Islam by Western mainstream media or people in power, but to keep an open mind and judge the Muslim faith fairly.
The Muslim community are kind and peaceful people, and it's ridiculous to prejudice a whole huge community just because of the actions of one or two people that aren't following the faith that so many of them believe in, and that it's unfair.
More than anything, Professor Shakespeare's book is an economist's view on some of the biggest issues facing humanity, from the vices of capitalism to climate injustice, and whether Islam is the answer. The final chapter envisages the makeup of a true Islamic economy.
At the heart of an Islamic economy is the use of money, which is genuinely interest-free, not pretend. And when you understand that, when you understand that money is today created out of nothing, the way is open. A massive supply of interest-free money, as long as it goes out and is repaid and cancelled. And you can use it in countless ways.
In a world where Islamophobia, as well as economic and other injustices, are on the rise, Professor Shakespeare argues there is a need for a new reset, a paradigm shift. And it's exactly that paradigm shift, he proclaims, that terrifies the West. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The first shipment of U.S. military supplies has arrived in Ukraine. The military contingent is worth $200 million and includes ammunition. The delivery follows the conclusion of the latest round of talks between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. Russian troops are massed on Ukraine's border, along with an arsenal of tanks, fighting vehicles, artillery, and missiles amid the U.S.-led NATO buildup near the border with Russia. Moscow has denied planning to invade Ukraine, but the White House believes an attack could come at any point. As the crisis escalates, EU leaders have become increasingly vocal in expressing their discontent at the exclusion from the diplomatic top table.
It's not just the US and Russia. If you want to talk about security in Europe, Europeans have to be at the table, and the agenda isn't just the issues Russia has put on the table.
Many believe that the EU is currently politically divided and lacks a unified approach on the Ukraine crisis. France's President Emmanuel Macron has said that the EU must open its own talks with Russia rather than rely on Washington. Macron hopes to revitalize four-way talks between Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine, known as the Normandy format. However, the Baltic states bordering Russia seek a hawkish approach. On Friday, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania announced plans to send anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine after receiving authorization from Washington. But Germany disagrees with this approach, with its defense minister Christine Lambrecht ruling out arms deliveries.
We have to do everything to de-escalate. Currently, arms deliveries would not be helpful in this respect. There is agreement on this in the German government.
The German defense minister says Ukraine will receive a complete field hospital together with necessary training in February. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has stressed Berlin's policy of not supplying lethal weapons to conflict zones. Berlin is also under pressure from the US and other Western allies to stop the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will carry Russian gas to Germany and the rest of Europe. EU and US leaders have time and again said the project should be halted if Russia attacks Ukraine. But Germany has warned against linking the natural gas pipeline and the row with Moscow over Ukraine. Meanwhile, the EU was sidelined from talks held last week between Russia and the US, NATO, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The EU has threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it attacks Ukraine, but the 27-member bloc is divided as to what should trigger sanctions. It seems that as the crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling, the division among the EU states on one side and that between the EU and the US on the other side is becoming more evident and increasingly widespread.
Oh.
As COVID-19 restrictions are eased, millions across the EU are returning to work. However, many businesses are struggling to stay afloat due to rising energy prices. The pandemic has resulted in more people working from home than ever before. Their bills are also out of control. EU energy ministers met on Saturday to discuss the crisis.
Être plus efficace.
We need to be more efficient, better interconnected. We need greater solidarity when it comes to security of supply. We need to stop wasting energy and protect citizens from more energy poverty.
Consumers are angry at the EU for not being better prepared to ensure sufficient supplies.
It's getting ridiculous when you're paying like 150 a month and you're used to this amount, and then it gets raised to 300. It becomes a problem.
With the pandemic, like you said, it's really difficult because people are struggling economically. They're getting fired from their jobs. Some of them are struggling to find new jobs, and this is coming even more.
Governments in 22 of the 27 EU member states have taken temporary steps to try and support businesses and households, but so-called energy poverty continues to rise.
Many ministers mentioned how the situation beyond the EU eastern borders creates uncertainty on the markets and how the gas flows from Russia have dropped significantly in recent months.
But the European Commission acknowledges Russia has honoured all of its gas supply contracts. Moscow insists it's willing to supply more if new contracts are signed. This has already happened with Germany and Turkey, the Kremlin says. As was stated recently in the European Parliament, perhaps the best way to ensure energy security would be for the EU to stop using Ukraine to provoke Russia. This, as Ukraine is corrupt to the core and at the highest levels, according to the European Court of Auditors, which is the EU's financial watchdog. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There's no end in sight with the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload.
Donations made to this charity in West London on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in 3 decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, and you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will be most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages. The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty, and it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Sai Puriza, London.
In the limelight.
In Washington State and Texas, one study found 42% of child care workers experienced food insecurity, with 20% of child care workers experiencing very high food insecurity. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Colin Page, McKinn's journalist. This article is published under the heading, Around 1 in 3 Childcare Workers Are Going Hungry in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. Of the nearly 1 million child care workers in the United States of America, in a recent white paper, 31.2%, basically one out of every three, experienced food insecurity in 2020, the latest year for which experts analyzed data recently. Food insecurity means there is a lack of consistent access to enough food. This rate of food insecurity is anywhere from 8 to 20%. Points higher than the national average. In Washington State and Texas, one study found 42% of childcare workers experienced food insecurity, with 20% of childcare workers experiencing very high food insecurity. High food insecurity is when a person reports reduced quality and variety of diet. Very high food insecurity occurs when a person reports disrupted eating patterns and reduced food intake. Another study in Arkansas found that 40% of childcare workers experienced food insecurity.